Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Rick Ackerman. I represent the David. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time. To be candid with you, Your Honors, as I've been watching you this morning, I have my argument all printed out and ready to regurgitate. But I sense that it's the questioning of the court that becomes the really critical factor. So I'd just like to cut right to the chase and just say the ultimate question of this case is, where is the line? Where is the court establishing the line as to what a real estate agent can do and what a developer can do in giving legal advice to a prospective purchaser? That's the whole reason why we're here. We're saying you can't do that. You're supposed to say, I can't give you legal advice. You need to go consult an attorney. And they didn't do that in this case. What they did in this case is they said, oh, the 20% rule will allow you to rent to families with children, which was clearly erroneous. Any attorney would have told them that, as they had to admit, because afterwards they checked with an attorney and found out, yeah, that
was
erroneous.
Isn't the key question, why is it reasonable for your client to have relied on that comment as legal advice?
Okay. I really appreciate it, because that directs me where we should go. The critical factor when you're involved in the issues of legal advice, I think, comes down to when you determine what's reasonable, you have to look at the whole context. In this particular circumstance, the Davids were looking at it. They weren't going to buy it because they saw this clause, and they said, oh, gee, we don't want to buy this. And then their agent, Jessup, says to them, well, let's go check and find out. And so they go in, and they find out from Ms. Maddie that that 20% rule will allow you to rent to families with children. And Mr. David says, well, I want to make sure about this, so go check with your broker. And checks with the broker, comes back and says yes. Now, the question then that you're raising, is that reasonable? I'm submitting to you that on its face, it is reasonable. For the same reason that we see in the Jones versus Allstate case, here you have a situation where the adjuster comes in and says, I want you to, you know, give us this release, and we're going to give you X amount of money for this release. They knew that they were adversarial. They knew that they weren't representing them. They knew that they weren't an attorney. But that particular relationship was such that they said, oh, okay, is that the way it's supposed to be? Okay, and we'll sign on it. The reason the Supreme Court came down so hard on Allstate is because they're saying, wow, when you get into these types of positions, you know, there's a lot of societal harm that comes when you engage in that type of discussion. And they balanced it. And the question becomes, what is better for society? Do we have a situation where you just say, ah, I'm sorry, that's a legal issue, I can't give you that advice, you need to consult an attorney? Or do we just say, oh, let's see, I got a pecuniary interest in this, my commission depends on this. You know, oh no, this will allow it. We've checked and this will allow you to do that. So when you come down to the issue of reliance, I think our Supreme Court has ruled that, hey, the reliance is dependent upon the factual circumstances. And if you're in this position and you're asking that question and they don't tell you to go get legal advice like you're supposed to, like Graham versus Vindal says, you have an absolute duty to tell them, go get legal advice, and you don't do that, I think that supersedes any type of reasonable, whether you had a right to rely reasonably or not.
How about the reasonableness of relying on that kind of a statement? 20% of units can be occupied by families, 20% now, without knowing how many have been sold, how many to families, how many not to families. In the future, the Davids aren't buying, they're buying as adults, they're not buying as a family.
Well, that's true.
Out to families.
But they explicitly told them, we're going to buy this so we can rent it, and we want to rent it to families. So there was an absolute knowledge on the part of the real estate agents. They knew precisely what the purpose was. This is why I go back to the case of Buring Motors versus Balch. This is a very fascinating case. Of course, many of us remember Dick Balch back in those days. But the bottom line of that is the court said, wait a minute, you cannot withhold or give erroneous advice, even if it's an honest mistake. You have a duty either to give accurate advice or you have to say you really need to go get legal counsel.
How can you establish your claim, though, if you can't demonstrate that representation came with a guarantee that in perpetuity I would have access to one of the 20%.
Well, I think it's the issue is this is the interpretation of the statute, and they're saying this statute allows this.
And that's literally true.
And that's no, it doesn't.
The statute literally says
yeah, but
80%.
Well, yes, but the problem with that is that what we're doing is we're interpreting that statute, and they're saying that statute will allow 20% to have children, and that is not what the statute allows.
How do we find that? We don't have an expert witness who says that. You're saying we can infer it because
the
broker talked to an attorney and said, well, I changed my mind.
No, the broker goes in after this had occurred. Right. He goes in and he asks and he says, hey, you know, can't we do this? And the attorney says, no, you can't do that. You can't rent to people under 55. Now, there's a whole host of reasons behind that, and I didn't realize that that was going to be a subject of the argument because it's been a given throughout the entirety of this litigation. If I had that opportunity, I would brief it. I can only tell you that from that statutory standpoint, nobody allows in under 55, over 55 communities, they don't allow children, okay?
But the statute allows them.
No, the statute. No, the statute.
And why does it say 80%? Up to 80%.
No, this. What? I know that's what the statute says.
Right.
But that's not how it's applied, and that's the critical factor here. If you're interpreting that federal statute right now to be that way, to allow 20%, then why did the condominium association come in and force my clients to negate the lease that they had?
Why is he even entitled to rely on the representation of the statute when the covenant expressly overrode that and restricted it to adults?
No, the covenant didn't. If you go look at that covenant in the POS, you'll see that it says in it there's an exception to it, and that exception was if you pay the school the school fees, then you can have children. I mean, that was the conflict that occurred that caused Mr. David to ask the question, can I really do that? Thank you.
You have two respondents. Have you decided how you're going to divide your 10 minutes?
No, Your Honor. Just one moment.
I'll take 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Now you have.
May it please the court, Brian Cossette on behalf of respondent Eugene Bryson and Georgine Maddie. Your Honors, this case is relatively simple. David's claims are all based upon a pre-contract statement that was a mere conveyance of information from the seller and declarant, Dick Nord and Nord Northwest, regarding this application of this age restriction. It's important for me to point out at the very beginning that David had his own agent. David failed to name his own agent in this lawsuit for reasons that are unknown. But David likes to talk about these duties that are owed and that we owed a duty to refer them to expert counsel or to attorney, but that's absolutely not the case. The case law that David has cited in their briefing, all of it is State v. Marks, has to do with drafting of a will, advising people on the will, typing up a will, delivering of a will. Buren v. Baubach has to do with drafting a lease and failing to advise a party of their legal rights and the implications of it.
If you tell somebody, here's what a restrictive covenant means, isn't that legal advice?
I don't believe so, because our statute expressly authorizes a real estate broker to rely upon information conveyed by another party. So 1886.030 specifically authorizes a broker, and these are the duties, 030 duties apply to all parties in a transaction. They allow them to convey information from another party in the transaction without any independent duty or inspection. This 1886...
Unless it's the unauthorized practice of law.
Correct. But I don't think that the mere conveyance of information from a seller becomes the practice of law. In fact, there's no case law in the briefing that supports such a notion. I'll submit to the court that a nationwide search, as well as federal, I found no case law that found that the mere conveyance of information without an independent interpretation is the practice of law. And in here,
how do we know? Maddie says, if I read the record correctly, says, yeah, 20% are available. Not that the seller says 20% are available.
Well, that's not what the record reflected. The record reflected that she went back and conferred what the understanding was, and there's declarations from her that the training received from NORD was at 20% of these units allowed. So
that she did that, but when was that communicated to David?
That was communicated to David before they even made an offer on the in the transaction.
That the information was, the source was the seller?
That's correct, that it was confirmed. And further, that was, again, a pre-offer statement. And the issue is that, so we have a pre-offer conveyance of information, nothing more. There's nothing else. There's no drafting of documents in this case. That's it. Then David goes to his own broker and asks him to draft a contract. Did David ask him to draft a provision that provides for or guarantees that he's going to be one of these 20% units or that it's subject to this? The answer is no. The contract also was very clear, and I don't need to go in great detail, but with respect to that he agreed that he's not relying on any prior oral representation, that it was an integrated contract, that there were no other representations. And then more importantly, the contract specifically gave David a right to terminate the transaction based upon the public offering statement. And the public offering statement is where this restriction was found, and it explicitly on the front page cover advises David to go seek legal counsel. David failed to take any steps, any reasonable measures to further investigate this, and in fact was given a contractual opportunity to do so, yet he failed to do so. And then he stands before the court and says, well, it's their fault, when in fact he had his own representation. Our client did not represent David in this transaction, was in fact adverse. But by statute under 1886.030, she's allowed to rely upon conveyance of information. And importantly, 1886 is the codification of, it was codified, I believe, in 1986, of pre-existing law. And one of the decisions was Hoffman v. Connell. And that had to do with claims against brokers for an erroneous legal description, a legal issue. And the court found that brokers are not guarantors of that, and they had no duty to verify information received from their clients. 1886.030, which was passed shortly after that, parrots that language almost identical. Now, they talk about that we have a duty to refer her to a counsel, to legal counsel or an expert. Those duties only apply, those are not the general duties under 1886.030, but that duty only falls under the duties that a broker owes their own client. And so under 1886.050, David's broker, Jessup, would have owed that duty. However, the statute is clear that a broker does not owe an adverse party in a transaction that duty. No such duty exists.
Is there a dual agency problem?
There is no dual agency problem, Your Honor. There's no dual agency. Number one, it was consented to, the fact that it was a dual brokerage. And I know that they've raised an issue that we had a duty to, and that we breached our duty to inform David that both brokers were from the same brokerage. But that's absolutely false. If you look at the record testimony, number one, the front page of the PSA indicates, and he consents to, both brokers being from the same brokerage. And further, the deposition testimony is uncontroverted, that he acknowledged he knew full well that both brokers were from the same brokerage. Now, they try to get around this by saying this is the practice of law. So when we open this can of worms of the practice of law, then we have all the duties that go part and parcel with an attorney. And they reference RPCs and other things. But we never get there because the mere conveyance of information from a seller to a broker and a broker to a prospective buyer is not the practice of law. There's no case law to support such a jump. There's no evidence before the court. That would be drastic if we were to hold that the mere conveyance of information, whether it be square footage, septic, permitted, these are all things that brokers routinely in their day-to-day practice convey on behalf of their client to other parties. The contracts allow the other party a time to verify that. There's a 10-day information verification period. Further, with respect to the specific issue raised in this matter, the public offering statement explicitly provided and advised them to seek counsel for an attorney. Now, they raised an issue in their response briefing that you can't do that, that's not fair, that there's waiver. But all the case law that was cited talks about whether there was waiver of a warranty and whether that was fair and whether that was bargained for. And that is not the issue before the court. This is a front page that advised them to seek their own counsel. Your Honor, no matter what cause of action we're talking about, there's just no reliance. There's no evidence before the court. And further, with respect to Defendant Gene Bryson, the only reason he's named in this lawsuit is because he is the owner of the brokerage, but his duties are solely statutory. There's no dispute that he never had any interactions with Nord before the transaction until after it closed. So there's no indication that he even provided brokerage services. They don't dispute that. And by statute, 1885 are his only regulatory duties. And in Woodhouse v. Remax, the court, has been clear that 1885 does not establish a private cause of action. Your Honor, and then lastly, the mere fact that an allegation of unauthorized practice of law is raised does not take us outside of 1886. There has to be proof and there has to be evidence that the conduct rose to the level of the practice of law. And all the case law supported is based upon far greater circumstances with respect to drafting of contract, the Allstate decision. They were, thank you.
Your Honor, I in my I can get through this in a minute and 30 seconds, I would like to give the remaining minute or 30 seconds to my...
And you're Mr. Nord.
I'm sorry, yes, Your Honor, I am Mr. Nord.
Thank you.
Your Honor, first of all, the Mr. David failed to get to the right party, get the right party in front of the court. This the Corporation Nord Northwest should have been the viable party here, not myself personally. I brought this out in my affirmative defenses when this case started in 2008. My affirmative defenses indicated that I was not personally involved. I was acting only as a corporate president. I had never acted in any other way. In fact, I had never even met Mr. David prior to him buying this thing. I had not even had a conversation with him of any kind prior to that time. My corporation was active. It was appropriate. It was operating appropriately with all the laws of the state of Washington with respect to standards for conduct of corporate officers. I think it's interesting that Mr. David's attorney points out that I did not provide any case law to support his contentions. But my argument isn't about acting as an attorney. My argument has always been that I shouldn't be here personally. I should have only been brought into this case corporately. And if he wanted to pursue that, then he should have pursued that, but he didn't. I'll yield the rest of my time to Mr. Kassetti.
Thank you very much.
And this is my time. Just two more points, Your Honor. And also, with respect to the negligent misrepresentation, there's no expert testimony. Hoffman v. Connell is very clear that expert testimony is required in order for a plaintiff to prevail. He alludes in briefing that you can take judicial notice of that, but however, that's only under the practice of law, where you obviously are still lawyers. You can take judicial notice of that. You're not licensed real estate broker. There's no case law that says that you can find what the reasonable standard of care is for a real estate broker. And then lastly, Ramos v. Arnold, claims directed to the competence and strategies professional are negligence claims. They're not. They're exempt under the CPA, and there is no basis for liability against my clients. Thank you very much.
Thank you. About 3 minutes.
Thank you. With regard to Mr. Jessup, I'd point out that they never raised that in their affirmative defenses. This is the first time that they're raising it now before this court. However, I don't think that that's necessarily relevant, because the bottom line is, if you give legal advice, you give legal advice. If you tell somebody the statute means this, then that's what you have done. And it doesn't matter who else is involved. And this goes also to Mr. Nord's argument. I think it's very clear from the Nordic versus Grayson case that if you engage in conduct personally, regardless of whether you're the president of your company or not, but you're the one who engages in that conduct, you become personally liable. And Mr. Nord, and everybody agrees, nobody denies this, Mr. Nord is the source of this 20% rule. He was the one who stated it, and then they conveyed it. Now, the issue when they start raising this thing about conveyance and that there's no court case, et cetera, that flies in the face of the Burien Motors case. Burien Motors case was all about an agent who knew what the purchaser wanted, wanted to use it for certain things, and the conveyance issue was zoning requirements. And the court held even the failure to convey proper information when you know that, or alternatively, to direct them to get legal advice independently constituted the practice of law. Now, when the statute was enacted, this that they like to cite so much, I think it's very instructive to read Section 110, because in that the court or the legislature explicitly says whether you don't get to engage in either the authorized or unauthorized practice of law. You don't get to do that. If you do that, this statute doesn't apply. So when you start to raise those types of issues, I think you have to go back and look at what it was that the legislature intended and explicitly stated in the statute itself. The duty to persuade has been a constant that we've had for many, many years. When the Supreme Court decided the Coltam Heritage House case, what they were looking at and they were trying to figure out is, okay, we've got to get a balance here. We don't want to tell real estate agents they can't fill out a form. That would be ridiculous. But on the other hand, we don't want them engaging in the practice of law. And what did they say the practice of law was? Giving legal advice. And they said there's an affirmative duty that you must persuade. It doesn't say, you know, you should have, could have, would have, suggest. You must persuade. That is the language. And that's what they failed to do. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all. That concludes our session this morning.
Court is in recess.